Welcome to our panel on bringing climate change closer to home. Climate change is obviously a big story. The challenge for us as journalists is how do we make it small? That is, how do we bring it down to a local scale so that our audiences can relate to it, understand it, come to grips with it, perhaps address it? And if you believe, like me, that climate change just might be the most important of the story of the century, then this topic also becomes very important as well. My name is James Fahn. Like many of us on the panel, I wear several hats. I am the executive director of Internews' Earth Journalism Network. We are a global network of environmental journalists, kind of like SEJ, but on a global scale. We have over 4,500 members around the world, and I would certainly encourage any of you who are interested to become members. It's free. You can go to our website at www.earthjournalism.net and check us out. I also am a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. I teach a class there on international environmental reporting. And in my earlier life, I was a journalist for many years based in Southeast Asia, covering all sorts of issues related to the environment. So I can tell you that as, you know, working with journalists around the world, one of our main challenges is to work with them to help turn this huge global issue into a local story. We are very fortunate today to have three experts with us on the panel who are going to help us to try and do that. To my left, I'm not going to give long introductions because you have their bios, but to my left is Linda Marsa, who is the author of a recently published book called Fevered, about health and climate change. And she is a contributing editor at Discover magazine. To her left is Willie Schubert, who is a senior program coordinator for the Earth Journalism Network and I can tell you from personal knowledge, a digital whiz. So he's doing a lot of interesting things with online media. And to his left is Imelda Abano, the director of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists and also a woman of many hats. She's also doing a lot of amazing things in the Philippines with her network of journalists, and she's an SEJ board member. Unfortunately, we are missing one panelist today. Dave Cleaves, the communications expert with the U.S. Forest Service, cannot join us for reasons you're probably already familiar with. we're sorry to miss him. The silver lining there, though, is that each of our panelists will get a little more time to speak. The format we'll have here is they are each going to have an opening presentation of about 8 minutes. We'll allow one or two questions after each presentation, but then we'll go on to the next speaker, and there'll be plenty of time for Q&A afterwards as well. And as usual, you know the format. If you have a question, and we certainly encourage questions, please state who you are and who you represent, and journalists first. But we're going to begin with the presentations, and for that, I'm going to turn it over to Linda, please.
Well, thanks, James. Thanks for having me. I've been asked to talk about, obviously, the links between climate change and health. And as James mentioned, I just got done writing a book about that. And that was my biggest challenge, was how to take, you know, some abstract science and put it in real terms that were meaningful to readers. So in the course of my research, I discovered that there were several key areas where climate change was going to affect our health. And as I go through them, I'm sure that this will stimulate ideas in your brain of how to tell stories. And then I'll also talk about some of the stories that I derive from this. The first one, the most obvious one, and the one that we're probably feeling most significantly, is that we're going to have more natural disasters, floods, hurricanes, fires. And these natural disasters really strain the healthcare system beyond its natural limits. We saw that with Hurricane Katrina. You know, there's a lot of debate whether that was climate change caused, but, you know, the trend is that we're going to see more Hurricane Katrina-like disasters. Just to quote one alarming statistic, there were 16 hospitals in the New Orleans area. Only three remained open for months after Katrina. People were practicing medicine in storefronts, on card tables, and storing vaccines in ice chest. So clearly these were not optimal conditions. One doctor told me that, you know, healthcare in New Orleans was unacceptably primitive for years afterwards. Mortality rates went up by 25% after Katrina. Suicides rate doubled. You saw five doctors commit suicide in the year after Katrina. So there's the mental health effects, too, of displacement. The second area is that, you know, we're dumping almost 32 gigatons of CO2 in the atmosphere a year, and which is beyond my comprehension. I think 1 gigaton is 1 billion tons, and, you know, so 32 gigatons, I figured it out, is something like 60 times the weight of every person on the planet, and we're doing that every year in the atmosphere. So as I always say to my husband, what could go wrong? But what we're going to be having is increasingly bad air, and we already have pockets here in the United States where we're seeing the kind of air that we're going to have over other parts of the country as this carbon continues to accumulate. So this increasingly bad air triggers rising rates of allergies, asthma, heart and lung disease. Heart disease is associated with pollution. It irritates the lining of the arteries and causes plaque, which causes heart disease. I even saw one study that says breathing in air pollution contributes to dementia. So that's something to explore, too. We also have the ecosystems are changing. You know, it's getting warmer, period. It's pretty simple. And what's happening is that disease vectors, and what we're talking about are insects, mosquitoes, ticks, even deer mice, deer, are migrating to newly warm habitats and changing ecosystems. And so we're seeing, you know, a disease like West Nile virus gained a foothold. West Nile, as the name implies, is indigenous to the West Bank of the Uganda River District, and now we see it here in the United States. And for various reasons, the mosquito that carries West Nile is now be able to thrive here in this country, and now we have West Nile virus here. We have dengue fever is now endemic in the United States. We just had a local outbreak in Florida, and what we mean by local outbreaks is that it wasn't like somebody had dengue in Mexico and brought it here. The dengue now lives here in Florida, and there was a local outbreak also in Texas. We had a Hantavirus virus pulmonary syndrome outbreak at Yosemite last summer, killed two people. Thousands of people were exposed. Valley fever, which is endemic in the, as it suggests, in the Central Valley of California, because that area is getting drier for various reasons that I won't bore you with because I only have 8 minutes. Environmental belt that's hospitable to valley fever is expanding. So these are just some examples. Higher temperatures also mean spikes in heat-related deaths. This is especially significant in places where people don't have air conditioning, in higher populations of the elderly since they're more susceptible to heat stroke, or in places where residents are not acclimated to hot weather. In other words, people in Miami can tolerate hotter weather better than people in Toronto. And in developing countries, you know, the drought-driven collapse of agriculture is forcing people to migrate to these large urban megacities. And surrounding these large urban megacities, you have these urban shanty towns, which are really breeding grounds for infectious diseases. And what you're seeing is an emergence of zoonotic diseases. And zoonotic diseases are diseases that jump from animals to people. We saw that with the SARS epidemic, and I believe it was 2002 or 2003, you know, where you had the SARS, which jumped from pigs to a pig farmer. And then the doctor that was taking care of these people in a province near Hong Kong went to Hong Kong for a wedding, and he stayed on the 12th floor of the Metropole Hotel. And the reason why we know this is because of what happened afterwards, and all this stuff was sort of tracked back. You know, you can figure what happened. Everybody who stayed on that 12th floor the next morning checked out of the hotel, traveled to all kinds of different places, and brought the SARS with them. So these are all different types of stories that have a strand that's climate-related. Here again, in developing countries, you know, people don't have air conditioning. In the future, you know, experts are predicting that we could see die-offs that surpass what happened in Europe in 2003, where 70,000 people died, or in 2010 in Russia, when the double whammy of heat and fires claimed 52,000 lives. And I just want to say parenthetically that, you know, the Russian leadership has resisted acknowledging that climate change is happening, and the 2010 heat wave forced them to admit that climate change was actually happening. So these are sort of the general ways that we're going to see climate change impact health, and also in the developing world, we're going to be seeing more violence and civil unrest that's climate change related. I know there was a big study that came out about a month and a half ago. And, you know, some of this stuff is just basic common sense if you sit down and think about it. We're starting to see more droughts in the sub-Saharan belt. And, you know, when people are starving, they kind of get angry. I mean, who blames them? And there has been a definite causal relationship between drought and the rise in civil unrest. So we will see that. And in developing countries, obviously, all these impacts are greatly accelerated and intensified because they don't have the infrastructure to protect them the way we do here. And that leads me into another issue that you can also write about, is that climate change is an environmental justice issue because the health impacts of climate change hit the poor, the disenfranchised, and people of color the hardest, because they're least likely to have air conditioning or to be protected from vector-borne diseases or to have an infrastructure to protect them. You know, we saw that, you know, in the aftermath of what happened in New Orleans. It was the poor and disenfranchised that were affected the most. You know, the people who were more affluent had the resources to leave, to find medical care afterwards. The same thing in New York. We did learn some lessons from Katrina, but we didn't learn all of them. One of the lessons that we seem not to learn from Katrina, and I'm only being slightly snotty about this, you don't put the generators in the basement when you're on a floodplain. I mean, really. I mean, NYU had the generators in the basement. I don't know what they were thinking. The same with Bellevue. I mean, in the middle of the storm, I know you're shaking your head. That's what I did, too. In the middle of the storm, they're evacuating people 12 stories down dark and there was no elevator, so they're taking them down darkened stairwells. So we did learn some of the lessons, but not all of them. You know, you had stories in New York of, you know, people who were, you know, on the verge of diabetic comas that were, you know, stranded 12 stories up without any kind of medical care. One of the things that I found most significant about New York was Doctors Without Borders, for the first time in its history, set up a clinic on American soil in the Rockaways. Anyway, I've been told that I have talked enough. So I will bring this to a close. But there's a lot of ways you could see where you can find stories.
Thanks. Thanks, Linda. We'll take one or two questions now if you have any. I would just mention one of the reasons we wanted Linda here on this panel is because, of course, when you're trying to do local reporting on climate change, reporting on the health impacts is one of the most kind of salient issues for local reporters. So if you're out there looking for stories on climate change, go talk to your local medical experts or your academics who are working on these issues, because you can find really good local stories about the health impacts of climate change. Any questions for Linda now before we move on? Okay, Willie, it's all yours.
That's you. I thought the mouse was up. And so, hi everyone. My name is Willie Schubert. I'm here to talk about a mapping project that EJAN has been working on called Climate Commons. And Climate Commons is essentially the premise here is to help provide context, like the local context for climate change that you can drill down to, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or rural Minnesota, and find out, well, how is this affecting me on a monthly level? So more continuously updated information and more local narratives. So just a bit about me and the Earth Journalism Network, why we're here. So I'm the coordinator of this project. As James was saying earlier, it's a global network of journalists. One of the things that I do, besides helping coordinate, provide training and things like that, is I make maps to help integrate cartography into news stories all over the world. I also do a bunch of other things. So, like, one of the things, I'm going this weekend down to New Orleans, which is going to have another maybe hurricane. I'm flying out tonight to talk to the public lab. They do balloon mapping. Here I'm teaching a bunch of people in D.C. how you can make your own satellite, putting cameras on balloons and flying them over things. So this is EJN. This is all the cities of that we had that journalists who are members are in. So as you can see, it really is a global network. And we're collaborative. So one of the things we do is we help set up partner organizations. So like Imelda next to me is the president of the Philippine Network in Asia, but also SCJ here in the U.S. is one of our partner organizations. So the way we work is we try and connect different groups together to collaborate on stories, to share best practices, ideas, things like that. And so what, just to kind of contextualize what I'll be talking about, it's kind of in this context of geojournalism. So you might be wondering what geojournalism is. So the first thing is the maps. It's that geo part. And what we're using these maps for is evidence. So this is data-derived journalism saying, well, this is the issue, here's the data, this is backing up what we're saying, but there's not always a geographic literacy. It's hard to read what a map is saying all the time. So what we do is we overlay these maps with stories from reporters, local reporters, or in the case of this project, it's an aggregation using Google tools of all stories in the U.S. about climate change. The purpose of those stories is to really add context. So once you identify some pattern, you want to see the story. What does this pattern mean to me? So this combination is what we call geojournalism. So as I was kind of explaining a bit why, so this interactivity allows a user to explore. So we don't always know, like a story itself is often linear. Mostly a linear narrative of take you from here to there. But with a geojournalism platform, you can help people answer questions and then also come to the next one so that these platforms can be circular in their narratives. Once they learn one piece of information, they want to learn more. Or they can tailor what they're looking for to their specific context. And journalism, what we do, is really important because it's providing that background information, you know, the 5 W's and the H that are really critical to understanding. And then the other thing is that data is often collected by a lot of different organizations. I mean, we're an environment, you know, there's satellites in the sky monitoring everything all the time, but that information can sometimes be difficult to gather. Like, where is it? How do I get it? What are the rights to it? How do I treat it after I get it? Those are all big questions, so what we try and do is make it easier. So this platform is kind of based on our first project like this is called InfoAmazonia. And this is a map about deforestation and mining and development, hydroelectric dams and such. That's covering all 9 countries of the Amazon over the last 30 years. And it's updated quarterly. So this information is kept up to date. And the publishers here, you can sort by different media partners, things like that. So when I say I start here with this because this is a much more designed system. It's based on person-to-person interaction. We know all of these publishers. We talk to them. They use these maps. This is like a really direct partnership. But Climate Commons is a little bit different. And that's because we got money to start with Google. And so we tried to use Google for what Google does best, and that's finding and sorting information. So here's Climate Commons. So Climate Commons is also a continuously updated interactive map on climate change issues in the United States. It also features the latest news stories aggregated through Google News, also limited to the U.S. as well. And then this is kind of the special thing here, that these visualizations are dynamic. So when you're looking at the national level, you're seeing the national picture. When you zoom in, you can see the regional picture. And when you zoom in more locally, you see the local picture. So these maps are actually changing. And then the other thing is, after we pulled in all of these stories, there's a lot of information. And just this year already, we've got almost 8,000 stories on climate change from the United States. So how do we make these things relevant to people? Well, you have to filter them in some way or another to get people to the information that they need. So I have a quick video kind of showing this stuff. I heard that the internet was bad, so we will play a little video screenshot that I did before this. Hopefully you can see it. So now we're looking at the national level. This is climate emissions from industrial sources. As we're scrolling over, you're seeing the individual point sources of information. So like, and as, there you see the change. So we're looking at the national picture. It doesn't tell you that much. It's like, okay, there where people are. That's where emissions are happening. But as you start zooming in, you're like, okay, it's Rust Belt. And then, all right, well, it's the Rust Belt, but it's actually these specific cities that are the sources of the most information, of emissions. And then you zoom in there, and you can even start to getting to the neighborhood level within cities of where the emissions are coming from. So what we're trying to do is say we have all these points. We got a ton of points. We got, I think it's like 11,000 emission sources. But if you just put points on a map, it doesn't mean a whole lot. So what we're trying to do is show, generate a color that says, all right, it's heavy here. Check this out. Keep zooming in, and then you'll find that specific source. We want to get you to that specific source that you're interested in, the neighborhood that you live in, what's going on. But before you get there, what's the national picture too? Where do you fit in the bigger picture? So, yeah, I use Jing. Sometimes it sucks. Go to the next one. All right. Okay. So, yeah, we got it. All right. So I just am going to go very quickly. Okay, question. EPA, Greenhouse Gas Registry. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's an issue. And I'll go over that a little bit later in terms of where we're trying to get information. But let me quickly go through what we already have. So this is NOAA data. We have weather normals. This is temperature normals. We also do that monthly, so we change it monthly so that, all right, we're looking at August right now because that was the picture that I had. But so what's it supposed to be? Based upon the weather normals for temperature, for precipitation, and this is also at a national level. If you were to zoom in, I could show you a bit more, like, local variation, but we can't do that because internet. Here's precipitation, and here's wind. So here's all of the normal stuff. Here's all the anomalies, which is also monthly. So this is temperature anomalies for August. Here's the precipitation anomalies. So this is percentage differential from what that first set would be. So you can reference, like, all right, this is what it typically is. This is what it was this month. And here's also extremes. So these are wind extremes. And it's actually interesting. You can see wind. These are damaging winds. And you can see this, and these are fires. So when you're looking in between these two things, you can get a real clear picture. Wind is an eastern problem. Fire is a western problem. And then you can zoom in and see a bit more detailed information about where these fires are actually happening. And then here's that emissions layer that we just went over. So here's the other thing is stories. And you may have seen in that video how I started zooming into some of these stories, and you could click through and be like, okay, those stories are also filtered based upon where you're looking on the map. So as you zoom into the Midwest, those stories that you're getting in this sidebar over here are just about the Midwest. So it's filtering out all the stories that are about Seattle and saying, here's the stuff about the Midwest. This is what they wrote about fracking in Pittsburgh last week. So it's a discovery tool for journalists. The other thing you can do is filter. So we have filters for causes, opinion pieces, awareness-raising pieces that are often tied to like NGOs and stuff, the impacts and costs stories, and then policy and response stories. So those are filtered based. Basically, we set up some alerts in Google News, and we say, all right, climate plus survey will put us into that awareness kind of section. You see, our climate plus storms will be in the impact section, so that we can say, what kind of stories do you want to be looking at? And so we're basically setting a kind of like a tubes, like a series, like the internet is a series of tubes. And so we're setting up our tubes to get the information to this story bar based upon the criteria that you want. And then also Google is very good at text analysis. So you can know what words are written. We can see if, all right, I'm in a room full of journalists. Please put the location of your stories up at the top. You know, that used to be standard practice. People don't do that anymore. That's actually super helpful for us, because if you put your location of your story at the top, we will easily be able to geolocate it. If you don't, we get other kinds of problems, like, you know, Berlin, Pennsylvania. The New York Times writing about Berlin, Pennsylvania, about, you know, some, you know, bigger name issue. So we do text analysis. We also have people, humans in the system that are checking to make sure that these stories are in the right place. And all right, so the next steps. Oh, 1 minute. Okay. So this system needs to be improved. We need to increase the speed of the system because Google is really good at points on map. I'm sure you are aware that it's really fast and good, but when you start to do more complex visualizations, like with these hexagons and these redrawing, it becomes a little bit slower. The other thing is, with that InfoAmazonia map, we have an embedding tool. So what you can do as journalists with that map, and we want to build it for this one, is create a custom embed code, like a YouTube video or whatever you want to embed. And it says, all right, this is the location I'm looking at, this is the data type I'm looking at, this is the story I want. Take this size, put it in my story. So it makes it a lot easier to put maps into your stories. The other thing is, we're thinking about ways to integrate citizen reports here so that it becomes more of a two-way platform. We would also filter that in a specific way so that you would be able to separate citizen reports and also scientific research. So do the same process with Google Scholar and say, all right, well, what research about South Florida is available about climate change? And then filter according to who's writing it. The other thing, you know, I'm sure you guys know, climate change is a major political issue. So one of the things that we've been looking at is tracking legislation and also tracking campaign contributions and seeing, so when you look at, and also advertising dollars spent in certain markets by who. So where are people putting in money to influence perception around climate change? And then what are people saying, media saying, in those markets? And then lastly, this is more of a just simple one that just kind of messes with me, is the hexagons, they go over the borders. It kind of pisses me off. But that's something I want to fix too. And then if you want to learn, all right, I got no time. If you want to learn more about this stuff, we just published a geojournalism handbook, which is a set of tutorials with our partner in Brazil. I think it's like geojournalism.oeco.or.br because it's Brazilian. But if you want to look it up, there's all kinds of great stuff from the Guardian Interactive team, from the guy who did Map Kibera, from myself, and it's growing all the time. So this will be a nice resource, and yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Willie. Any questions out there? Yes, please tell us who you are.
So there is a way that you can submit your stories directly. There's a button that says submit a story, and you could add it to the database because it depends on what Google considers to be a news agency. And there are ways to get around that, and we do have this workaround which says just submit what you think should be on there. But we're kind of at the mercy of what Google considers to be news. That's also why we don't want to use Google all the time anymore.
Another quick question? Anybody? Okay, thank you, Willie. Willie, you might want to just post the URL for Climate Commons, yeah?
Sure.
And we'll have more time for questions afterwards. Imelda, what's going on in the Philippines?
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming to our session. Well, just last week, at least 7,000 persons were affected by typhoon in the Philippines, and 30 people were killed. So this is my country, the Philippines. It's a very small country, low-lying nation in Southeast Asia with a population of 301 million. And we have like 7,100 islands in high tide. So the Philippines' reputation as storm central has made it the best place to witness the power of nature. Typhoons, droughts, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, you name it. Yes, Philippines is the best laboratory for natural disasters and climate change impacts. So we are visited by about 20 typhoons a year. That's an average. So every time there is a typhoon, we do have this flooding. Well, the heavy and excessive rainfall we are experiencing is part of what climate scientists call the new normal. And the issue of extreme weather events and climate change has become a big issue enough not to be ignored by the media. Despite the country's vulnerability, the Philippine media has paid little attention to the reporting of climate change and its related issues like disaster. So most often, climate change as a news subject is treated as part of a disaster reportage or the doomsday scenario. So it's understandable because of, you know, just imagine 20 typhoons a year. And it's becoming more and more fiercer. But a bright light in disseminating information about climate change lies in the new media. In the Philippines, some journalists have turned to new media platforms and tools like Facebook, Twitter, and mobile reporting to reach wider audience and tell stories in an interactive ways. So taking advantage of technology to assist the public and journalists alike in reporting this kind of situations, we have been looking at new ways to deliver the message. The development of mobile phones and text messaging help once isolated journalists to disseminate their stories to varied audience. In the Philippines, around 2 billion SMS are being sent every day. So it's the largest SMS volume in the world. Mobile technology subscribers have grown by around 100 million in 2013, this year. So just imagine, they prefer to have mobile phones instead of, you know, buying food. Where so in April this year, the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists embarked on a small project, the Philippine Environ News, wherein we train journalists to integrate SMS reporting using any mobile phones on environmental issues, climate change, and especially disaster events. So, and thanks to InterNews, of course, and the Earth Journalism Network for their support. So using this innovative reporting system, journalists, even those in isolated areas, were able to report fast, real-time information on disasters, typhoons, and flooding with just 140 characters. So it's really localized. The project integrates mobile reporting and social media to increase the reach and community stories to a wider and more global audience. So in with the project, the local journalists just text tips and reports into a system using the free tool Frontline SMS. It's very open. It's free, and you can also use it and integrate in your reporting. So you can just download the Frontline SMS. Verified information is then reviewed and posted to the dedicated website, which is the environnews.ph. And it's finally pushed out, of course, to social media. We also use Facebook and Twitter. They say we are the third country in the world who use Facebook. So whatever technology we have, we just use it, you know, whichever is available, cheaper. And I think this is an example of harnessing technology, especially in reporting climate change, disasters, and other environmental issues in the local communities. And we are taking baby steps. Maybe the next steps that we integrate geojournalism to map stories and map journalists wherever they are.
Thank you. Thank you, Imelda. Any questions for Imelda? You know, while you're thinking about that, I've been teaching, training journalists for quite a few years now on how to report on climate change, and I've come across a few tips myself for ways to localize your reporting, so I thought I'd just share some of them. One key is consider using different angles, right? And this may seem obvious for many of you, but you'd be surprised how many journalists kind of just stick with their environmental angle. There's so many different angles that climate change is going to affect everything. So the stories you write or report about climate change can really touch any of the different desks or editorial categories at your media organization. You can do climate change stories about business, about science, about health, as we've heard, about politics, of course, But you can also do a food story about climate change. How is climate change going to affect your local food supply or affect the kind of foods that your region might be famous for that your farmers locally grow? Gardening stories. Now people really like stories that affect their personal lives. So how, you know, you have a lot of gardening aficionados out there. How is gardening going to change? How is travel? What, you know, the many sites we like to go to. People love, you know, reading about travel stories. So the destinations we want to go to, how are they changing? Money, right? Personal finance stories. Maybe climate change will be affecting what we should be investing in, things like that. So I would certainly encourage you to really think outside the box when reporting on climate change. It doesn't just have to be disasters or, you know, changing temperatures. Climate change is going to affect our entire society, our entire economy. So look for stories everywhere you can. Another good tip is talk to old people, right? They're the ones who know best of all how things are changing. I mean, really, if you just go talk to your neighbor. You know, how are things different now in the weather? Now, it's not a scientific necessarily story, but if you collect enough of these impressions, you might really have a good story. I know, for instance, in my hometown, just a small example, I grew up in New York. We used to go every winter. The local pond would freeze over, and we'd go ice skating there. Well, nowadays, sometimes it doesn't freeze over. Many winters, it just doesn't freeze over. It's a small thing, but if you're in a small town and it was a part of your life, it's something you relate to. Talk to old people. See what they see is changing. Collect local data. We've been talking about data journalism. Certainly the easiest way to collect local data is go talk to your local college or scientists who are doing that. But increasingly, you can collect your own data using sensors or come up with your own citizen science projects to figure out how things are changing in your hometown. You can use polls, right? Well, you know, there are polls certainly nationally about what do Americans think about climate change. Well, what do people in your hometown think about climate change? These days, using social media, it's quite easy to do your own polling. So maybe that would be something that you could embark on with your media organization. Investigative reports photos, okay? Especially a good idea, look for old photos. Maybe you're at a newspaper that goes back, you know, decades. Maybe they have pictures of the way the glacier nearby looked or the forest nearby or different ecosystems nearby. Maybe that's changed over time. Collect those old and new photos and compare them. That's one of the best ways to document the change that climate change is bringing about. And finally, a story that you may not always think about is most of the stories are on climate change are about mitigation. You know, how do you prevent it? You know, clean energy, stories like that, certainly very important. Or about impacts, right? How is climate change going to affect us? But the other angle is adaptation. How are people, communities, towns, states, countries, how are we adapting to climate change? And sometimes that might be through a government-funded project. But sometimes it's through what people are doing every day. How are farmers changing their planting habits or their harvesting habits? How are, you know, city planners accounting for changing seasons or animal migrations, invasive species, things like that? So tons of stories out there, and I'm always happy to talk more about these strategies. Any questions? Okay.
Yeah, James was talking about the stories out there, and I kind of talked too long, so I didn't get to this part of my discussion. But if we have a little bit of time, you know, in terms of the health, there's a lot of things that are going on in terms of adaptation, which are really important. The Centers for Disease Control is beefing up its surveillance network so that it can identify disease outbreaks sooner. A lot of these emerging diseases that we're going to see more of, like dengue and West Nile, don't have any vaccines, do not have any treatments. There are scientists out there that are working on these treatments because they're emerging diseases. I mentioned that we're going to start seeing more of these zoonotic diseases that scientists and health officials are really worried about jumping from animals to people. It seems like a lot of these diseases are coming from Asia. They're trying to set up a surveillance network in Asia, in Singapore, with Singapore as the headquarters. So that's another really wonderful story in looking at that kind of thing. The other thing is the mitigation and the adaptation strategies. New Orleans has set up a public health system that is now much more resilient in the face of disaster, and is doing many things that can really withstand, you know, being flattened again like that so that people won't lose their health care. So there's a lot of things that are going on in that area. And the way that I found people was, you know, real people, on-the-ground people. You know, obviously you go to public health officials, you know, you contact the usual sources, you know, experts at universities, you know, scientists with the government. But, you know, also through Facebook, you know, putting out notices on Facebook, through Twitter. One of the things I did, and I was actually proud of myself because this actually showed a little bit of reportorial imagination, I did a lot of real-time reporting on heat wave in Moscow. And what I did was I got on these expatriate blogs and I interviewed people that were American citizens, because I don't speak any Russian. I interviewed people that were American citizens in Russia and, you know, in Moscow. And you could obviously do this when you have, you know, other outbreaks or other kinds of extreme weather events or whatever it is in other parts of the world to get this kind of reporting. So I just wanted to add that.
You have a question?
So Michael Codis from the Center for Environmental Journalism in Boulder, Colorado. I write a lot about natural disasters, particularly since I now live in disaster land. When we look at local stories like this, there are also some drawbacks to how you do local reporting that have come to bear pretty heavily on us. So I'll give two examples really quickly and see advice for how to deal with those. You know, one is I write a lot about fire and wildfire and have for many years. And if you report out of the forests above Colorado, you know, you'll routinely hear from people, well, I've lived here for 40 years and my granddad lived here and his granddad before him and we've never seen a fire, so it's not a hazard. When the reality is you're dealing with a fire cycle that happens every 300 or 400 years. So yeah, the fact that you haven't seen a fire actually means that the risk to you is greater, not lesser. But the public doesn't see it the opposite way. And in the case of the floods that we just had, we reported in a piece for Time.com that immediately after the fire, this was a 1,000-year rain event that Boulder received. But the flooding that we had was only between a 25-year and a 100-year flood, depending on which watershed that you're looking at when you talk to scientists. But immediately, media, including Time, which after our story ran, had other stories that referred to this 1,000-year flood, which is misleading to the public in a very dangerous way, because if you're telling people that this is a 1,000-year event, it's not likely to happen again in your lifetime, whereas actually we've seen a flood like this just a couple of decades ago, and we're likely to see another one within the next 10 to 20 years. And so people generally aren't as prepared for, you know, this disaster with this thing that happens, you know, infrequently, even if they think climate change is increasing it. So I'm curious as to what ideas about how to report these things so that you can get into the nuances and complexities of the local data, the local information, so that you are presenting this at, you know, how things are changing locally and the threats that we're looking at, but you're actually parsing the scientific information in a way that's digestible to them and is both reflective of the local concerns, but actually putting it in an accurate context.
Anyone?
Okay.
Well, so the question is, how do you report the time frames for natural disaster stories? And it's a good question. It's certainly a challenging topic. I think it's really important to be clear about the time frames, as you suggest, that, you know, that the 1,000-year rainfall might be different from a 100-year flood. And this is one of the key ways that we can, you know, chart the onset of climate change, if you like, if we're seeing floods more frequently, right? So it's all the more reason to be precise about those statistics and make sure we have it clear. Because if we're seeing 100-year floods come now every 10 years, as scientists are projecting may be the case in the future, that is one of the clearest indicators of climate change. So so I would say, you know, it's really important, as you say, to be accurate and precise about the frequency of these events, and to make it clear to the public that, yeah, as you say, you know, this forest fire may, you know, and one of the big challenges of climate change is it's happening on time scales that humans are not really comfortable with, right? I mean, it's geological time scales that we're comparing it to, so it's hard for us as people to understand, and therefore, again, all the more important for us as journalists to be clear about why this is, why things are changing, you know, how things are changing.
Right. I mean,
well, one of the things I wanted to add is I saw that about the 1,000-year floods, and I kind of cringed when I saw it because it wasn't really accurate, and then everybody thinks we're a bunch of liars, you know, if there's one little factoid that's wrong. And I think that there's a move now with NCAR and NOAA to sort of change the nomenclature, because when you're talking about a 1-in-100-year flood, what you're really talking about is a 1-in-100 chance of it happening. And I think that that's what we really need to be clearer about, because, you know, when I spent almost a month down in Australia, which is kind of on the front lines of climate change, and I visited this guy who was out in St. George, out in the middle of the bush someplace, and he lives on this river, a beautiful spot, and he had experienced a 1-in-100-year flood twice that year. So you get my drift. So I think that, you know, that's one thing that we really, that's our job as journalists, is to start explaining this in a meaningful way and unpacking it so people can understand it. So we have to say that these 1-in-100 things are happening more often than we would expect them to happen. And it's not that it's just a 1-in-100 year. To answer your question about the fires, I mean, it's not just what, you know, some guy is seeing, you know, up in, and I know you know this, up in the north, but, you know, I talk to firefighters and they all tell me the same thing. The fires are different. I mean, they're there on the front lines. And, you know, one of the people that I interviewed when I was down in New Orleans is this fire department captain. And his politics are to the right of Attila the Hun, you know. And when I was doing the book, you know, I said to him, I said, look, this book's about climate change. I don't want this to come out and you to feel exploited, because it's just not how I operate. I can find somebody else. And he said, I'm a firefighter. So I think that, you know, if you sort of expand, maybe, you know, and I know you talk to those guys, but you expand that, that's the one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, as I'm sure you know about, the bark beetle outbreaks, which have created, you know, more kindling for the fire. And for those of you who aren't familiar, I'll do this really fast. You know, the bark beetles carry, you know, this fungus that infects the trees, and then the trees die and it creates more kindling. And because of climate change, they're producing twice instead of once. And, you know, a season, do the math, and they're flying further. So that's just the quick, short one on bark beetles. So anyway, I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting that you brought up bark beetle and fire, because it speaks directly to what I'm talking about. And I actually worked as a Forest Service firefighter during this book that I'm working on, a fire. And science, pretty heavily now, says that the bark beetle infestations are not changing fire behavior.
They're not, okay.
They're not. And there's, you know, I did a literature review, I think it was 48 papers, and there's a range,
wow,
and some still see some change, but mostly science doesn't believe that it's, and I, you know, I can, anybody's interested, I can talk about this, but more detail than you want here. But indeed, the firefighters I talked to and incident commanders consistently, particularly through the last 4 years, and Colorado has broken its most destructive fire record now 4 times in 4 years, and there's, you know, absolutely a climate signal in that. But, you know, so firefighters are saying, yeah, we're seeing totally new fire behaviors, and we're definitely seeing more intense, more destructive fires in beetle-killed forests. So now you've got scientists on one hand that have been studying this for a really long time saying one thing that's actually the opposite of the people that are on the front lines of that. And they both are local data. And, you know, it kind of gets back to, you know, your idea of parsing these things. You know, when you talk about the flood, you know, what we've done as journalists is find a way to take a probability that's a little too complex for our readers and explain this in a way that's understandable for them. But it's, it's far too coarse for the type of granular information that we're trying to convey. And so I guess that's, you know, kind of, you know, getting back to my question is that, you know, there's a lot of ways to parse local information, and you can end up with totally different results, you know, depending on, you know, what your inputs are.
Hmm. Willie, did you have a comment?
No, I was just going to say that the for the kind of explanation of a scientific terminology, going to some kind of visual can be really helpful in terms, and just keep on using it as a support. Support for your story. Like, one of the things we're working on with online journalism is to create more of a, I mean, you see it often in online articles. You can scroll over certain terms and you can kind of get a further explanation. So we're trying to build certain databases that have visual information that do short explanations of terms. So you can say, all right, well, what does this probability mean? This is a risk probability. If you want more to explain this, if you're not really getting it, like, here, please check it out to clarify. Or even just putting it in your article can be helpful. Yeah?
Did anybody see stuff quarantine last week?
Can you please state your name again?
Heather Duncan. I'm a freelance reporter.
Okay.
Did anybody see last week Seth Borenstein's story on the 95% scientists being 95% sure about climate change? And he put that in the context of going to a bunch of scientists and saying, well, what else are we 95% sure of? And the prime example was smoking, that smoking harms your health.
Right.
To get the people, when they think the 95%, think, well, that's not 100%. And they jump on that. And it's another, I just thought it was a really good example of further explaining the context of probability or of some of the scientific information,
right,
where it was very concrete for just the general reader.
Mm. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Elissa Yancey. I teach at the University of Cincinnati, and I also report for WCPU.com. And my question is, what kind of uses would you suggest for climate comments for journalists and journalism professors? I'm working with Google Fusion and one of my environmental journalism professors.
Right.
We're actually mapping the Mill Creek, which is a big, it seems to be much polluted from the river. Is there some way we could tap into the data that you have?
Oh, yeah. Certainly. Climate Commons is also built with Fusion tables. So on every piece of data, you can download the Fusion table. That it's already put in the correct format. It also has the original source. So it's already in the right formatting. If you're doing Fusion tables, you can just pull it. It won't do the hexagons. It will give you the underlying point information. The hexagons was a way that we tried to solve the overloaded point problem. But what you could do is basically select out the region that you're interested in and delete everything else and just kind of copy what we already have and then remap it. Right, so yeah, that's like one of the ways that we try and make it a little bit easier for people to access information in a machine-readable format.
So for those of you not familiar with Fusion tables, I know it sounds intimidating. It's not. Google Fusion tables is a really easy way for you to create your own map with your own data points.
Right.
It's basically a spreadsheet, and you put in data, including a location, and Google takes that and turns it into a map with those points on it. So if you want to create your own map with your own data and your own data points, I really encourage you to look at Fusion tables. It's really easy to learn. Even dummies like us can learn it. So, and we're happy to talk about it here. But it's pretty powerful and easy to use tool. Is there a question here? Yeah.
Strategies we in the media can use to explain that to our readers, both without getting lost in the weeds of.
How do you explain risk? Anyone?
I think you wrote a thing on that.
Yeah, well, there are lots of different strategies. I always like the rolling the dice comparison is a good one. Odds, like odds in a game. People can relate to gambling odds. So we're loading the dice, right? The one, you know, when talking about the 1-in-100-year flood, I think, okay, it's a difficult nomenclature, but it does kind of make it easy to compare. If you have a 1-in-100-year flood happening every 10 years, that's an easy way for people to understand that these disasters are happening more frequently. And the other way is the IPCC way. You know, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They have their own nomenclature they use. So I think, as an example, they now say climate change is very likely to be caused by human activity. And they say, and they define very likely as being 95% certain. And they have other definitions. Likely is, I believe, 90%. Probable is 67%. So that's, you know, so using those percentages is a way to understand. It's not perfect, as Heather was saying. Some people, they're looking for 100% confirmed, and obviously we can't offer that. But I think it is a way that people can understand.
And also, like, just looking through things in Climate Commons, like, I often search for, like, insurance stories, because insurance companies are often the ones that are, they deal in risk. It's their business. And so you can just find examples by typing in the search bar, like, insurance. And you'll see, like, 10 different stories written about insurance companies. It's just ways that it has been handled. So I say probably one of the best ways to use Climate Commons right now as a journalist is to be looking at what other people are writing about and how they're writing it, and just kind of seeing, you know, what is the state of the game? Like, what are people doing? There's a question back there.
Anybody? Anyone out there in the audience?
I just think we live in a global ecosystem, and there's no way that we, because, you know, one of these questions came up about the air, and, you know, I was in a group like this, and they said, well, we're here in California, we've improved the air. And I go, we have. We did some great things. You know, we made all the cars have catalytic converters. We have higher grades for the gasoline and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. But we live in a global ecosystem. We can't put a dome over. I'd love to put a dome over California. Believe me, I love living in California, but you can't. So I think that, you know, sooner or later, maybe the impacts aren't, you know, direct. But sooner or later, you know, we're going to be impacted by other things that are happening in other parts of the country are going to be happening in your area. If only that, you know, the guy, we're spending a lot of money on disaster relief. You know, is it fair for people in Appalachia to have to subsidize the insurance of people in South Carolina who are idiots and keep rebuilding on the same floodplains? You know, these are all, you know, questions that come up.
Yeah, another example that I can think of is looking at other places in the world that have a very similar ecology. Like, I know in, like, the coal belt in China, it's another very similar ecosystem where it looks, you know, it's old mountains, rounded hilltops, and you can just see, you know, 10 years ahead of what the impacts are for a community that has a lot of similarities but also a lot of differences. So it also can help people understand how the world is connected in these ways. And also, as less coal is burned in the U.S. and starts being shipped to other countries, that's also another way to connect what's happening, you know, in their backyard to this big global picture.
I mean, it sounds like part of your the angles you're focusing on is the biodiversity changes of being affected by climate change. And biodiversity, sometimes it can be hard to explain what is the significance of a, you know, perhaps obscure species being lost. In those cases, journalists, you know, try to explain the importance of the web of life, you know, that losing species can have very perverse impacts in ways that we don't expect or understand. You know, maybe that salamander eats some bugs that, you know, and that salamander's gone, then you have more of some pest species that affects farms or something. And I would say, especially in rural areas like Appalachia, I mean, the agriculture angle, I would think, would be pretty strong. Okay, not everyone is a farmer. But, you know, it's something that a lot of rural folks can relate to, and it's part of their tradition and history. So to the extent that agriculture is being changed and will be changed by climate change, I think that's a pretty powerful story to report on. Yes, Heather. Good point, gnat line. I never knew there was a gnat line. That's, I'm learning something here. This is great. We're getting a lot. I'm sure many of you have good strategies and tips to provide, so please don't be shy. Let us know how you guys report locally on climate change.
Well, you know, just to add something, I was just in Atlanta, and I had to take an antihistamine when I was there. I went out and bought some. I don't need antihistamine. So that was very interesting to me. You know, also when you're reporting on Georgia, you can report on the history. I'm kind of an idiot, and I always wondered, how come the CDC is in Atlanta? Why isn't it Washington, D.C.? And then I found out that the reason that the CDC was, you're nodding because you know, but the original CDC was founded to combat malaria, which was endemic all over the South. And this might be an interesting thing. Now, public health officials aren't worried about malaria, so I don't want to give you the wrong impression. But they are worried about dengue. They are worried about West Nile. And they are worried about a lot of emerging diseases that are coming from, you know, South America and are migrating northward. So that might be another thing, a wrinkle that you can report on. Because I know Georgia and that whole area, you know, even, you know, Washington, D.C. used to empty out in the summer because of yellow fever epidemic. So, anyway.
Why aren't public health officials? Tell us about malaria. Why isn't that a risk?
Well, just because we've got, we live behind screens. We're not outdoors that much. We're smart about it. We have a really good surveillance system so that it won't spread. So they're not really that worried about malaria. You know, I mean, there are imported cases where people are sick with malaria and they'll come and they'll get sick and maybe the mosquito might spread it to other people because there are malaria vectors here in the United States, mosquitoes that can spread malaria. But this is why the Center for Disease Control is building up its surveillance network, because if they can identify what's going on quickly, they can contain it as quickly as possible. That was the problem with West Nile. They had no idea what was going on, and a government report came out in 2000 that said if they had identified it much quicker, they could have saved lives because they could have, you know, really contained the outbreak.
Before, just a moment. So I lived in Southeast Asia, and I was unfortunate enough to get dengue fever, and it is really nasty disease. I mean, it really knocks you out. I just want to bring Imelda into the conversation. Is there any discussion in the Philippines about health impacts of climate change? I know the focus has mostly been on natural disasters, but what about health?
Yeah, we also integrate health issues in climate change reporting. Just like what they've said, malaria is really, really risky in developing countries like the Philippines. So many deaths already, and it's really hard to cope. But when we do stories like that, we see to it that we talk to experts, explain things to local communities, so they can tell them that you have to what do you call this? You have to take care of these things, do this and that. It's like information education to local communities.
Questions, comments? Yes, Chris.
Seemed to me that the expectation was that it would be just a much bigger problem than it's turned out to be. Can you help us with that?
Well, I don't think they knew, you know. But I'm not sure that was a correct thing that they thought it was going to be a much bigger problem, because, you know, West Nile has existed in Uganda, and you know, we've had focal outbreaks in Israel. I think that's where the outbreak started. Right, and that's what they think. It was some guy going to Whitestone and smoking cigars on his, you know, and stuff. But I think this gets back to the whole malaria question. We live behind screens, so we don't get, you know, bitten as often, and we're much more protected. We're sort of hermetically sealed, where, you know, people aren't, you know, say in developing countries. They sit outdoors. They don't have screen on them, so it doesn't. These kinds of vector-borne diseases don't spread as much. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, just in terms of, I don't know whether only doing a story about West Nile is a way to bring home to the public that the climate is changing.
Right. Because it's not, well, dengue either. But I think that we're seeing more and more of these. I mean, I don't want to get into all the. But with the changing weather patterns, we're seeing the spread of valley fever, hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, which, you know, again, it's changing ecosystems. What happens is you have extreme drought followed by these heavy rains, you know, the deer mice that spread this hantavirus pulmonary syndrome explode. You saw that in Yosemite. We saw that in Four Corners. So that's the other thing that they're worried about, is a lot of these dormant illnesses that we haven't seen in a long time are going to crop up, or things like valley fever, because the ecosystem is changing or spreading. They think that valley fever infects about 200,000 people a year, and that's just in the Southwest, and it's not really identified. So, you know, and actually, you know, with valley fever, you know, they're looking at 300 or 400 fatalities a year, and it's like one of these little sort of unreported diseases. And what they're finding with valley fever, I mean, one of the guys I interviewed, one of the expert doctors, says, with this, this was the kind of mortality rates that we had with polio, which we found unacceptable, and we found a vaccine. So I think your question is good about West Nile, is that we are seeing deaths, we are seeing, you know, neurological deficits, but no, we're not seeing, you know, 30 to 40,000 people getting West Nile every year and 10,000 people dying. No.
Yeah.
Are developing, and you have developed it. It's in action now. Are you looking at using that in other developing countries? Is that something that is replicable? I took a class to Tanzania this past spring, and we'll be going to India with another class, and one of the things that I'm really looking at doing is trying to empower. I mean, I was amazed in the rural village, where everybody had a phone. And you can text. And I'm wondering if this kind of information gathering could be replicable around the world.
Right. Actually, the SMS reporting started in Indonesia, where they involved citizens to do the reporting with them, pitch in like some tips that there are illegal logging happening here. So I think we just replicated it, but we just involve journalists first, local journalists, and then we'll think about if we have to involve citizen reporting.
Yeah, so the project in Indonesia, we helped to support at Internews and worked with in West Kalimantan with local Dayak to monitor illegal land encroachment by the palm oil plantations. And what they did is they set up an SMS network that included local villagers, but also policemen, teachers, and media. So whenever anyone spotted some encroachment, they would text it over the network, and the police would pick it up. The media that stationed in the main town would pick it up and do a story on it. And it did help to kind of put a check on some of the grossest malfeasance.
You can use it anywhere.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're kind of up to next is working to build a more of a kind of plug-and-play solution for setting up a network like this in terms of the technology. Because right now you need to have a dedicated computer that is kept on all the time, and you have to have a modem that has a SIM card in it that can access the GSM network, like the cell towers. But basically you can use it without the internet. But one of the things that we're trying to do is to build some more custom hardware, so using things like Raspberry Pi, but a little bit different. If you're familiar with some of these very cheap microcomputers that you can plug in at low power that do one thing, so that it makes it easier to leave on for a longer period of time. You can use multiple numbers. You can hook it into the internet and use virtual phone numbers. You can also store all of your information on an SD card and then take it out if you're in trouble and you need to either hide or destroy that information.
We've got time for one more question. Heather, yeah, go ahead.
Linda, and maybe someone else may have an answer too, but one thing that I have frequently run into is any attempts to link health impacts with a direct cause. And we know, so, you know, climate change obviously is such a long-term thing that even proving, you know, a particular storm, for example, have any kind of, you know, relationship to climate change versus what we're doing anyway, or
Well, this is what we run into with climate change, is that the scientists equivocate. You know, they won't be definite. And I agree with you. And I mean, the way I write about it is that, you know, climate change is a driver. It's one of the drivers. But, you know, with the spread of infectious diseases, the evidence is fairly clear. You know, I just did a blog post for the PLOS on the migratory patterns of the 80s albopictus mosquito, and I always say I did it so you don't have to. I mean, it's really, you know, it's like, please, I put hot needles in my eyes, you know. But the point is that the Aedes albopictus arrived here in 1985 in Houston. And, you know, this is something that came from, you know, Southeast Asia, Japan, you know, and it kind of thrives in warmer climates. And now it's in Connecticut, and it's moving up to Maine. So we see the migratory patterns of these disease vectors as they're moving northward. I'm not saying that climate change is the only reason, but it's definitely a driver. And I think that you'll find scientists that would definitely go on the record as saying that.
I mean, you want to talk about the guy, the scientist? So in one of the classes that James helped set up at the University of California, we were speaking to a scientist about how to ask questions of scientists. And asking for causation is something that is going to turn them off immediately. Mm-hmm. So being a bit more vague about the role certain climate change has in it, they can speak to that. But just framing your question as asking, was this caused by that? They'll always give you a vague answer. But if you ask them a bit more gently about a role that climate change played in this, they might be a little bit more forthcoming.
Any final comments or questions before we break? Okay, can we have a round of applause for our panelists? Thank you very much.